The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Sonia Yusech-Kuhn of the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Community Connections. Every month we will introduce you to people in the community who are making a difference. My guest today is Bill Camp. So let me introduce Bill to you. Bill was born in Lamars, Iowa. And amazingly, that is the home of Blue Bunny Ice Cream. When Bill was six, his father, who served in World War II, joined the American Red Cross and worked with them in service to military installations. From first grade on, he had the life of a military brat. We're going to find out what that is. Their family moved a lot. For example, first to Arkansas, then to South Dakota, and back to Iowa. Next was a tour in Japan and back to Iowa. Then Oklahoma and St. Louis. He began his sophomore year of high school in a military dependent school in Stuttgart, Germany, and was lucky enough to spend all 3 years there. He graduated in 1966. In his German high school, a history teacher directed him in the play The Diary of Anne Frank. This history teacher and friend graduated Wake Forest in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Bill applied and was accepted, never having stepped foot in North Carolina, let alone the campus. Bill joined the debate team and majored in speech. He took every introductory course in humanities that was offered. He ended up with a minor in religious studies. He had limited funds, worked part-time for spending money, and was not involved in campus life. Between the summer of his junior and senior year, he met and married his wife, Marty, who he met when he was hanging theater lights during rehearsal for a play. They consider that they have a theater marriage. Even though he was accepted at UNC Charlotte and UNC Greensboro to continue grad school in clinical speech, tuition rates were not in his budget. So instead, Bill took a job as a court counselor working with juveniles. Good fortune prevailed as Marty and Bill learned about the School of Social Work at UNC Chapel Hill. They were both accepted in the part-time social work program. They graduated in 1974. Marty worked in public health, and Bill went to work for the State Division of Social Services. Bill split his career in state government between the Division of Social Services and the Division of Aging and Adult Services. He retired as planning chief at the Division of Aging and Adult Services in the year 2000 and continued working for another 13 years part-time at the UNC Institute on Aging. His focus was particularly related to long-term care. FOR stands for Friends of Residents and is a citizens advocacy group formed in 1987, intended to improve the lives and conditions of facility residents in North Carolina. Bill served on the board as chair from 2002 to 2004. He took a break and returned to Friends of Residents in 2018, again serving as board chair. Currently, through a grant received from the federal government, Friends of Residents is in partnership with the Social Work Department and North Carolina State University. Their mission is to develop a resident council guidebook with supporting training videos for facilities to use to create functioning councils in long-term care facilities. Bill and Marty have a married son and two grandsons. Bill gardens, keeps bees at his home in downtown Raleigh, spends time at the beach, and enjoy summer trips to Chautauqua, New York. Welcome, Bill. I am delighted that you can join us and share your exceptional career in social services for the people of North Carolina. So, Bill.
Sonia, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you. Well, it is especially a pleasure to be on Radio Reading Service Program. Both my wife and I have been longtime supporters, and Marty is actually a fill-in announcer from time to time. Any month that has a fifth Thursday, she'll be on the air.
Well, that's wonderful. We're a family now. So, Bill, I wanted to know about this. I've heard the expression a military brat. I don't know exactly what that entails. You could describe maybe for us the rules and the liberties of a military brat?
Well, I was thinking about it. You learn to pack light. As a child, for example, I always wanted to play piano, but it turned out to be clarinet because that is just a whole lot easier to move. Early on, we moved every summer, and that meant changing school systems, making new friends, saying goodbye to existing classmates. But the experiences were also very rewarding. I was able to see, to go outside of the country, first in Japan and then in Germany. And that makes for a unique worldview as an adolescent and then as an adult. So when you live on a military base, you share a common experience with other military dependents, particularly when you're outside the United States. It's being akin to living in an American ghetto. You shop at a PX or a post exchange. You buy groceries in an on-base commissary. You go to school in a military-dependent school system. We watch movies on base, and we listen to the radio on Armed Forces Network or AFN. It was only radio then when I was growing up, but it now includes television. But I grew up listening to radio shows from the 40s and 50s. These were shows like Jack Benny, Fibber McGee and Molly.
Oh yeah,
the Shadow. It was definitely an experience different from other kids my age.
But you really weren't a brat, were you?
No.
It's just an expression.
Right. I remember the day President Kennedy was shot. I talked to folks my own age, and that they were in school. I was actually with my brother at a movie theater on base. It was evening then in Germany. Uh-huh. The movie stopped, and we were all told to go back home. And when we got home, we turned the radio on, and they were playing Mozart's Requiem. First time I heard it. At the end of it, the announcer came on and told us that the president had just died. That was a vivid memory.
Yeah.
It was also a little different for us because my dad was a civilian. Just a degree of separation from the others. But when we were in the United States, we were just like living in the community with everybody else and going to school.
Okay.
It wasn't any different at all.
All right. So pick one state of all the states that you had lived in. Which was your favorite besides your home state?
Well, that was hard. So you're right. I will always have a connection to Iowa. It's my family's home state. My grandparents and extended family were there. My aunts and uncles, my folks, were the only ones really to leave town. Can't say the same for my cousins. But I learned the importance of family connections, even if you're not there. I have to say, I really bonded to St. Louis as a young teenager. I became and still am a Cardinal baseball fan. My life in Germany, though, I think defined me as a young adult. I came of age as a young adult, experiencing other cultures, gaining an understanding of how we live in a world, not just the boundaries of our own borders. As you said, I came to North Carolina because of my high school history teacher, and he just passed away, by the way, last week.
So sorry to hear that.
Yeah, we had stayed in touch over the years. It was a surprise. He was 88, and you know, there's an expression about live well till you die.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what happened to him. He was alive and active, and then passed away.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but obviously he played a large role in your life.
He was a good man.
Yeah. So, tell me something. In the Diary of Anne Frank, which part did you play?
I played Mr. Fondant. Mr. Fondant is Peter's father. Peter was Anne Frank's love interest as they were hiding away. And that was a fascinating experience. It was that was 1966. It was only 20 years after the end of the war, and we actually put that production on in front of a mixed American and German audience. It was very, very powerful.
So, now that you had a taste of applause, are you a thespian now? Do you do theater now? Or did it end with that final curtain call?
That was it wasn't exactly the final curtain call. As you noted, my wife and I met in Wake Forest, but I have to say I'm not involved in theater now, other than being an audience member.
We need audience.
To Raleigh Little Theater and Burning Coal. And that's our regular go-to date night if we have them. We're very much looking forward to a time post-pandemic when we can return to more in program or in present experiences.
So talk a little bit about this merger you had with this young woman, Marty, that you met when you were both young. And shared a lot of your college years and similar careers.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Sure. So as I said, we met in a theater. We weren't exactly an instant match, but it was close. In addition to theater, we had taken a couple classes in common while we were at Wake. We married actually pretty young. It was between my junior and senior year in college. Marty was a year ahead of me, and she had just graduated. She took a job as a social worker at Forsyth County Social Services. And I had another year to go to complete my degree. Now, when I finished, as you noted, I was going to go to graduate school in clinical speech, but I was an out-of-state student, so we decided maybe it'd be good to work for a year. And I got the job in the juvenile court, and we discovered this part-time social work program at Chapel Hill. And that program takes 3 years to complete what's normally a two-year program. For us, that was a perfect way for us to continue schooling and still pay the light bill. So that's the path we took. Now, Marty is a clinical social worker. So she started in public health and then went to work for the Division of Mental Health in the Department of Health and Human Services. And even to this day, she still has this small clinical practice that keeps her hand in, although she's post-retirement here. And I'm the other kind of social worker. My career has also been with the Department of Health and Human Services, but I've always been in program or planning positions. And that's actually how I got involved in aging-related services in the early 80s. I worked to help set up North Carolina's Community Alternatives Program. It's a special program funded through Medicaid intended to support people who qualify for nursing home care but with additional help can be cared for safely at home. And that's what gave me the long-term care bug and it's been my policy focus ever since. So, well, Marty and I have different career paths. We're close enough that we laugh about it, but this stuff is often our pillow talk.
Okay. Does this include assisted living, which is so popular now and has been for the last 20 years? They seem to spring up all over the place. And that's kind of a long-term situation. But people who live there not quite as ill or fragile or needing of care as the people in the nursing home. So do you have something to do with that area as well?
Oh, exactly. So the long-term care is actually a continuum of care from people who are living in their own personal homes or in other settings where there are alternate living situations. And as you noted, that assisted living is a part of that that continuum. I got involved in assisted living kinds of programs in the mid-90s, where we were involved in a reform effort in North Carolina to improve the policies that we had that related to assisted living. We actually called it domiciliary care before then.
Say that again, please.
Oh. It was called domiciliary care.
Domiciliary.
And the regulations that had set them up hadn't really been revised in over 20 years. And so we had to kind of bring them up to date with what was going on in assisted living. The people who were in that level of care, while they were a step down from nursing homes, their needs were becoming more and more and more complex. And there was a very diverse population which we found in those settings. And we were trying to make sure that staffing was appropriate and that the residents in care could get the kinds of services that they needed. And while I was working at the Division of Aging, that was an effort that included several divisions within Health and Human Services, mental health, social services, our regulatory agencies. And that's really what got me into the institutional side of long-term care.
So what is it meant when we see an advertisement for an assisted living facility that says continuum of care? Is that still getting the person closer to the time that they would need a nursing home situation as well?
It could mean several different kinds of things. There is a care setting in North Carolina called a continuing care retirement community. And that may be what you're referring to, because they certainly do a lot of marketing, and those entities, those facilities, actually have multiple levels of care, and they range from independent living, people who are living in apartments, or sometimes they're freestanding houses or duplexes or triplexes, to assisted living, to nursing home care. And so they do provide a level of services to all folks at whatever level on that continuum. There are also facilities that may not have all three levels of care, but may have two of them. It's not uncommon for independent living housing kind of arrangements to also have an assisted living facility on the same campus for those folks who are no longer able to live independently, but who still don't qualify medically for a nursing home care.
Ah, that's the thing, the medical.
Right.
Yes, okay.
Right.
So let me say that your devotion to the aging population and long-term care recipients evolved, and then you became involved with Friends of Residents, FOR. And that citizen advocacy group intended to improve the lives and conditions of facility residents in North Carolina. So please comment on the group's work and your current connection.
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. So as you noted, Friends of Residents in Long-Term Care is a citizens advocacy group. It is a charity. We're a licensed 501c3. We were chartered in 1987, and we're there to improve the lives of those residents in our long-term care facilities. And we do this through direct services, raising public awareness about long-term care services and having a voice in the public policy arena. We have expanded our mission, actually, to include other settings of care other than institutional. It can include programs like adult daycare programs, as an example, or even in-home care. Our motto right now is quality care no matter where. I became aware of Friends in 1995. As I said, when I was working on this state reform effort, I met the FOR's executive director, Marlene Chasson, and she represented the consumer voice in our deliberations. And I was very impressed with Marlene, and I was very impressed with the organization she represented. So when I retired from the Division of Aging in 2000, I joined the Friends Board, and I've been actively involved either as a board member or a volunteer ever since. And this is, this is my second stint as the board chair.
I see. What kind of duties do you have as the board chair?
Well, as the board's responsibility is to set the overall direction and priorities for the organization as a whole, and as the board chair, most of it is just being the convener. We do have an executive director who handles our day-to-day responsibilities. The board is there to guide the overall organization and setting the direction. As board chair, I manage that. And the other responsibilities, of course, that board members and the board chair has is fiduciary. We're there to make sure that the organization has the resources needed to carry out our mission. It's not a huge agency or organization. We only have one staff person, but we do have expenses, and we're there to make sure that we've got the resources needed.
How are you financed?
So our financing comes from three, maybe four primary sources. The primary source, the one we go to most often, as I said, we're a charity, a private nonprofit. So individual donors are the main support for our program. So individuals can go to our webpage, for.ltc. And through our webpage, you can make donations, which are tax deductible. The second source of income is we have an annual meeting event, and it's a fundraising event, and that's next to our just individual donations. That has been our second largest sum of money that comes into our budget every year.
Okay, so Bill.
More recently, we've gotten into some grant support, and we'll talk about that a little more in terms of the project that we've got.
Let me interrupt for 1 minute.
Okay,
if
sure.
Someone wants any other further information besides the website, is there a phone number?
Our phone number is 919-782-1530.
Okay.
So they can call that number, and if our or if I get directives part-time, if she's there, she'll answer it. If not, you can leave a message and she'll
okay.
get back.
So now I know that there's a big project underway at this particular time. We have a few minutes left. I'd like you to talk about, well, quickly how you got the grant or where it's from, and a little bit of COVID, but tell us a lot about the grant, the project and its mission.
Sure. So the project is funded through the federal government. There's a process when nursing homes are penalized, when they have federal penalties, those funds are set aside to be used by the state to fund program improvement projects. And we applied for, along with NC State School of Social Work, to receive a grant, and we were selected. And the, so that underwrites this activity. So the purpose of the grant is to help support resident councils in long-term care facilities. Now, there is a regulatory requirement that if the residents want to form a council, that they're required to do so. Now, you talked a little bit about the pandemic, and I'll tell you, the pandemic has been an unmitigated disaster for long-term care residents. They're in the highest risk group for the disease and for its associated complications. They incurred the largest number of deaths related to COVID. Our response to protect them was to basically keep residents in their rooms. So they were essentially in prison for about a year and a half.
I understand.
It also cut them off from other residents. And so any resident councils that were out there ended. Well, now as we start relaxing those restrictions, resident councils are starting up again. So
that's really good news. We only have 2 minutes left.
So
if you could just
time to get
tell
back
us about the project.
Sure. So the project itself is we're developing a guidebook, a toolkit for facilities to use and residents to use in reforming their resident councils. Now, in addition to the toolkit, we're developing a series of 5 videos that will help support, set the stage, give them prompts in terms of the kinds of questions that they can address, different styles of resident councils there are, kind of helpful hints on how to deal with problems that come up in resident councils. So it's going to be helpful to facilities and residents to be able to reestablish this presence.
Well, it sounds absolutely and very encouraging and very, very exciting, and it'll be very good for the people who live there. So, Bill, I want to thank you very much. We've just about run out of time for this show.
I understand.
Thank you so much for gracing us with all the knowledge that you have, and I hope to see you soon.
All right. Thank you so much.
Well, we've run out of time for this month's episode of Community Connections. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. I'm Sonia Usech-Kuhn for the North Carolina Reading Service. Community Connections is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.